for members only. Golf Smarter number 248, recorded on September 14, 2010.
SmarterPodcasts.com. Delivering sound advice.
More on the future of golf courses with architect Chuck Ermish.
This is Golf Smarter, sharing tips and insights from golfers and golf professionals to help lower your score. It's worked for your host, Fred Green.
Welcome, and thanks so much for joining us for the Golf Smarter podcast. Today's show is part two of the conversation we began last episode with Chuck Ermish, golf course architect out of Shawnee, Kansas, right in the heartland of the U.S. Now, I hope that you also appreciate hearing the perspective of an architect as much as I do. Personally, I really learn a lot about strategy when I hear what motivates design elements. Ultimately, that helps me to golf smarter. But the bonus is hearing about the state of the industry. Chuck has a lot to offer from all sides, so I just couldn't stop asking questions. It's my problem. Anyway, welcome back to the Golf Smarter podcast, Chuck.
Yeah, how are you?
I'm doing fine, and as anybody who's listening knows, we just finished recording last week's episode just moments ago. Actually, it's been like a half-hour break. We both had to make some phone calls because we were so excited about spending another 30 minutes together. So we got some business taken care of, but we're back on the phone here, and I'm excited about asking you more questions about the industry itself, how golf course architecture is being affected by not only the economy in this country, but globally as well. But one of the first things that I wanted to attack was you talked about in last week's show, previously on Golf Smarter, you talked about how the developers are looking for assets on for their developments. They're looking for amenities. They're looking for things that say part of our community that we're building is a golf course.
Exactly.
Are they creative in any sense? Are they trying to do, you know, I mean, you even said more golf courses are closing than opening, and I think it's pretty safe to say that more people are leaving the sport than starting the sport. Are they looking at other ways of doing golf course architecture? Are they looking at the idea of maybe nine holes, and nine holes is not the greatest way to do it? How about if we try six holes, you know, and let people play?
Well, yeah, actually, that's a great question, and kind of feeds right into what I wanted to talk about a little bit.
Wasn't planned. that's why it took me so long to get the question out.
I've actually been promoting golf courses that are more user-friendly to females, to youth, to senior players, and to your higher handicap players. It seems like there for a while all the courses were being designed to the guys who were 5 handicap and up, and while they were great to go play and while those guys really enjoyed it, they're only making up about a fifth of the golfing population. So the bills just weren't getting paid because the courses were too difficult. So that's one thing that as a designer I'm looking at.
Wait. Now I got to ask you a question. You're saying that the players that are single digit handicap represent 20% of golfers?
Maybe a fifth of them, yeah.
Really? I would think it'd be more like 5% of golfers are single digit handicap players. It just seems to me the USGA is catering to, you know, even the PGA and the Golf Channel, they just cater to a very, very small minority of the golfers out there.
Well, they do.
Are you whispering on purpose?
That's true. what I'm saying is there are a lot of guys who are single-digit handicappers who probably shouldn't be single-digit handicappers, but it's because the technology and equipment is allowing them to be that good.
Oh.
And that's another whole topic. I mean, we could really go into that topic if you wanted to.
We'll cover how technology has changed the game from your perspective. That's very interesting.
I would rather get back into that. Okay. But basically, where we're at is, in the 90s, it was a lot of the named professional golfers who were owning the design companies. They were building courses that were elite courses, very difficult, but very scenic. And they were getting away with it because they were creating things that were destination courses. Okay, they weren't creating them for the 20 handicapped woman who wanted to go out and play in Ladies League. All right? But the business plan required that they have a certain segment of people, like the Ladies Leagues, to help the course make sense financially. So there was this, you know, catch-22 going on, a big catch-22 going on. So it's really been good because it's helped renovation business. I mean, I've gone in and softened a lot of courses because the owners are realizing they need a whole different audience to be playing them.
And now, define when you say soften a lot of golf courses. What does that mean?
Mm-hmm. Taking sand bunkers, turning them into grass bunkers. Taking creeks that were going through landing areas and piping them under and making it fairway all the way across. So taking some of the hazards that were built and actually turning them into softer, playable areas.
And are there architects who are adamant about not doing that? Are they saying, you're ruining the strategy of the course. You're ruining the game by doing that.
Yes and no, but honestly, if once an architect's done with the project, he rarely gets any feedback from it from the owners again.
And the owners,
unless he's in an exclusive agreement with them that nobody can change the course unless he approves it, but no owner's going to sign that.
So then, what will happen is the course is done by the architect. The course opens. The architect is out of the loop. The owner is hearing feedback from his general manager that the people are complaining about the playability of a course because of this creek that goes through or this bunker that's in the middle of the fairway. And then the general manager will make the decision or the owner will make the decision. Let's fill it up. Let's
limit.
And they don't even talk about it with the architect.
At the end of the day, they have to have customers.
Right.
And they have to create a product or maintain a product that customer wants to use. So they have the right to do that unless they have signed an agreement with the architect. And the only one that I know who has those types of agreements in effect is Palmer. You cannot change an Arnold Palmer golf course without his approval.
Interesting.
Yeah. Not a bad gig if you can get it. But
but you got to play on the tour for 40 years first.
Yes, exactly. So, you know, the way I always look at it is a golf course, basically, I look at it as a very living entity in and of itself, okay? It's meant to change. I mean, it's going to respond. It has to respond to nature. It has to respond to, you know, the development that's around it. It has to respond to business. So without being too simplistic, you have to actually build a course that is very simple, but has an appearance that is attractive. And that's going to be the one that makes you the most money.
And you'll find the demands of a course, say a resort course versus a community course. When I say a community development, as somebody who's building houses around it, are they completely different types of courses that you have to
design? Absolutely. Huh. Absolutely. And you know why? Because a resort course is a destination course. Mm-hmm. You may play it one time a year. You may play it one time in 10 years. You may play it one time in your life. Okay? And you're going to spend $220, $270, $290 to play that course one time because it's a destination. You can brag about it to your friends. You can say, you know what? I went out and shot 109, but by God, I parred that number four hole, and that's going to make the whole trip worth it.
Mm.
Whereas if you have a development, you need to know who's living in your development and what type of players you have to make that course work. Because you're not going to get a lot of outside play that goes into a private development to play their golf course. You're just not. Unless you have someone who's affluent who lives in there who has a bunch of buddies who play golf who he can bring in to play with him every week. So it's a whole different product. It's an entirely different product.
That's really interesting.
That's why some of the best public courses, okay, you go to a public course, and I'm going to use Kansas terms because that's what I know. Okay.
And I'll try to translate them to California terms.
A course in Kansas City that you could charge $27 for and $11 per cart so you can play golf for $38 would make a fortune in Kansas City. But the only way to pull that off is you have to have a course that people can get around in 4 hours, and you have to have a course that they don't feel like they just got the crap beat out of them. Excuse me.
No, that's okay. That's okay. We knew where you were going with that.
Because you want them to come back.
Right.
You want to develop just enough challenge that they can say, you know what, I bogeyed that hole, but next week I'm going to par it or birdie it. But at the same time, you don't want it so difficult that they're never going to want to come back. The thing has to be maintained. In other words, if a person pays $38 and they want to go play golf, they want a course that has nice tees, nice fairways, and a nice green. The rough can burn out. The rough can do whatever you want with it. But if they don't have nice tees, nice fairways, and nice greens, they're not going to come back.
Yeah, and to translate that to California, or to Northern California, if we can find a course that we can play on the weekend for less than $70, we will brag about the course more than our score. Mm-hmm. We'll brag about the price more than our score.
Right. Right.
It's frustrating.
So, you know, I mean, there's, from an architecture standpoint, which is ultimately, I think, where we want to keep this tied to, it's really interesting, and that's why I say I have to know what the owner envisions for his product. Because, or who his user's going to be. Because if I go in and I design a peep die style course, okay, pot bunkers everywhere, railroad ties, the tricked up, the whole thing, the greens are impossible to putt, all right, and 2 years after it's open, the owner can't maintain it that way, and he has to reduce to selling to Joe Blow, who's going to walk in off the street and want to pay $35. Project's going to fail miserably because he's going to pay his $35. He's going to go out. He's going to get his butt kicked. He's not going to enjoy it. And it's not going to be maintained properly. So it's really going to be a tricked up golf course. It's not in good shape. So, you know, it's just not going to work.
From your perspective, what do you think is the thing that you've noticed time and time again, that developers who are putting in a golf course in the midst of their project just don't get about golf? You just want to grab them by the shoulders and shake them, you know, and say, listen to me, you're missing the point.
The developers get sucked into the ego sales pitch of the architect that you choose. And they stop thinking about it as a business. And that's the biggest problem that I see.
They like the name dropping.
Mm-hmm.
They want to say, yeah, and our course, doesn't matter how it plays, it doesn't matter how it looks, but it's got Arnold Palmer's name on it.
Exactly. Exactly. Because developers are they have big egos too.
Sure.
I mean, they wouldn't be successful if they didn't have an ego. And I'm not saying that in a bad way. There's no negative connotation to that at all. I mean, developers have egos. They're ego-driven. They like to go out and they like to say, look at the development that I've done. Buy this lot in the development that I've done because this is the best development in this part of the state, blah, blah, blah. That's all ego-driven, in my opinion.
If you were going to, if you got hired by a developer who said, I really want to make this course, you know, friendly for women, youth, and seniors. Or let's just go this way. You know, the community we're developing is pretty much going to be women who are home with their kids who are now their recent empty nesters. they've grown up and their kids aren't at home. Maybe they'll get the grandchildren showing up occasionally. And then you get seniors, you know, so women and seniors, the occasional youth. How would you design that course differently?
I'm going to do a 9-hole course with a top of the line learning and practice center.
Now, would you put different tees so they can play 18 on it?
I'm going to do a 9-hole course because they're not going to be interested in playing 18.
Interesting. And what do developers think of 9-hole courses?
Developers love 9-hole courses.
Are they doing them?
They're not yet, but they will be.
You think if
after they listen to this, they will be.
Well, let's let everybody know. So wait, you think that developers will start moving towards 9-hole courses mainly because...
I really do, and here's one reason why, okay? A very technical answer for a very simple question. A golf course, okay, from a planning standpoint, a golf course is about 140 to 150 acres of land that's dedicated just to golf. Okay? So that includes all your rough, that includes your tees, your fairways, everything that is golf property. Okay? Technology has come along in the last 10 years, and people are hitting the ball 300 yards an hour. Right?
Yep.
Well, guess what? They're not hitting it 300 yards straight.
It's true.
Are they?
No.
Okay?
And not that many people are hitting it 300 yards, especially your women and seniors.
Correct. Okay? But they're hitting it more to the right, and they're hitting it more to the left. But what has happened is there have been enough lawsuits that have been coming to the table about people who have been hitting their swimming pools, people who have bought on a golf course, their house is getting pelted, blah, blah, blah. Okay? The lawyers are all getting together because they don't know how to handle it because there are no specifications for the sport as far as what are acceptable dimensions for the game. So lawyers are having a very difficult time with these cases. So the lawyers went to the American Society of Golf Course Architects, which I'm not a member of.
Why?
But we do have a society of golf course architects.
Why are you not a member?
I don't see the value in it for the work that I do. It's more of a, and I'm not going to downgrade the society because they do great things. They do wonderful things. But for where my business is, I don't find it necessary. I'm getting just enough work without having that tag associated to me.
Okay.
Okay.
And how long have you been doing this?
18 years.
Okay. All right. Establish some credibility here. Okay. All right. Go ahead. Continue with that thought.
Okay. So anyway, lawyers went to the Society of Golf Course Architects. Golf course architects all said, well, you know, our typical, when we design, we're using landing area zones, like from center of fairway to edge of golf property at, you know, if you draw a circle around that, we're using like 300 feet, so 100 yards, and that's adequate. Okay? Lawyers came back and said, well, we can't make you enforce this, but we're going to suggest that you now use 400 feet instead of 300 feet. Everybody said, okay, that's fine, whatever. Until you get back to the drawing table and you start laying out radiuses of 400 feet compared to 300 feet, and you realize that that's adding 40 to 60 acres per project of golf course land.
Wow. And they're saying, the lawyers are suggesting 400 feet just to limit their liability.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Well, and that's all fine and dandy until you realize that you're adding 40 to 60 acres per golf course per project. And you look at it from a developer standpoint, and a developer's saying, but I'm selling quarter acre lots. How many quarter-acre lots did I just lose in 40 to 60 acres of land that I'm now dedicating to golf course?
A lot.
And I'm selling those quarter-acre lots for $40,000 a piece.
Mm-hmm. And well, now I have to do maintenance on the golf course of that additional 40 acres. I'm losing money everywhere I turn.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. So it doesn't make sense from a developer standpoint to do that. And they're actually canceling projects because of that.
Hmm. Do you think that if in fact people start waking up to this concept and say, you know what, we're just going to start building 9-hole courses, do you think that will help bring new golfers into the game?
Absolutely.
And better practice facilities?
Absolutely. Do you know why?
Tell me.
They're not going to be tied down to looking at 5.5-hour rounds. So that's really what a round averages now on weekends.
Yeah.
Okay? So they're not going to feel like they're obligated to play 5.5-hour rounds. They can play in 2 hours. They can play 2 hours in the morning, and if they want to go back in the afternoon, they can play another 2 hours, and they're not tied to 18 holes.
Hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, right there, that's attractive to me.
Well, I've always felt like the three things that held people back from playing golf as opposed to starting, more people leaving than starting, is that it takes too long, it costs too much, and it's too hard.
Too hard. Now, the cost factor, okay, here's the cost
factor. Do you agree that it's too hard?
Yeah, I do.
Okay.
I do. Because they're playing on courses that were built for someone different than what their abilities are, but the business plan has made it their only option.
So, yeah, they're designing for, like we talked about before, for a small percentage of all the golfers, but do they generate...
Correct.
But does that small percentage of all golfers generate most of your revenue? I mean, is it like 20% of golfers are spending 80% of the money on golf?
If it worked that way, it'd be successful, but it's not obviously not successful. So that's what I'm saying. I mean, owners are waking up and realizing, well, yeah, this is great to have that type of course because we want that type of clientele to come in because we want to be known on the street as a player's course. But is that really going to help us pay all our bills at the end of the month? Well, no. So what do? Well, we have to create leagues. Well, we have to create specials to get other people to come in and play. Well, we have to do this. Well, we have to do that. Well, that's all fine and dandy, except for the fact that the people you're bringing in, the course is too hard for them. So.
Are a lot of courses being developed because they're trying to get it on the tour? So they just make them longer and longer and longer?
No, a lot of courses are being developed just because the tour is really not a factor.
Oh,
The tour is so selective. The tour is so selective in the courses that they play that it really wouldn't surprise me if the tour was going to developers and saying you're going to develop a tour course, because I don't think it's the other way around. I don't think that a general developer is going to go out and develop a course and hope to get the tour there, because I don't think the tour would look at it.
Mm-hmm.
Courses are getting longer and longer and longer is because technology is allowing for that.
But then what happens if you're saying the lawyers are saying instead of 300 feet, make it 400 feet, and the golfers are saying, yeah, but instead of making it 6,000 yards, make it 7,000 yards? That's a lot of acreage.
Yes, it is.
And it doesn't pay for itself.
No, it doesn't.
Oh, my goodness. No wonder this sport is in the tank.
And, you know, it's a really interesting... Most people don't think about this, but I see it every day.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, oh, my goodness. What are we doing?
I see it every day.
Yeah. And
so,
do you sit down with developers and say, you know what, maybe you should rethink this and think about 9 holes? Have you ever suggested to a developer that you really don't want 18, you want 9 holes?
Yeah.
And what if they look at you like a puppy who's heard a sound for the first time? It's like, what? What are you? What?
No, a lot of them are like, well, you're the golf guy.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And I mean, again, it's just because they don't really care what the product is as long as it helps them sell lots. They're not in the golf business. So if you can come up with a plan that you can sell an owner, and I made that comment at the very beginning of the last show that we did. I said I interviewed my owner 3 times. And then I create a plan that I can sell them that they can use. Because half the time they don't know what they want. They don't know what they need.
Hmm.
I mean, they know they want to sell lots, and they hear that golf is really cool and that they can probably get, you know, X amount of dollars for a golf front lot compared to, and they're running all these equations in their mind of, okay, what are the values of the lots? Well, if I can go in and create a 9-hole course that they can maintain the value of lots and the number of lots that they can sell at that value, and they're only getting 9-hole compared to 18, why wouldn't they? It's less land that they have to dedicate to golf. More sellable land for them. They still get an amenity. It's my line of thinking.
Hmm.
Had some pretty good feedback, too. So.
Really? Interesting.
Oh, yeah.
And so now let's talk about the technology part. You've been wanting to talk about how technology has impacted your line of work.
Just in that exact way that we just talked about.
I see.
Now all of a sudden our landing areas are 400 feet wide compared to 300 feet wide.
Okay.
And we have to go to an owner and justify why we're using more acres for a project. So it's helping. What it's really doing to the architect is making us think of new ways that we can route the golf course so that we have more holes that play together to common ground so that we can start hacking away at that extra acreage and bring that acreage down to a manageable point again. So, like, I've come up with a concept that I call the cluster concept. Okay? The cluster concept is basically this. Some subdivisions have what I call ghetto golf. You have houses on both sides of the fairway and on the end of the fairway, and there's golf in the middle. And then you go to the next hole, and it's the same way. So it's houses and golf in the middle. One hole. Right?
Mm-hmm.
I think we're all familiar with how that works. What I'm trying to do and what I've started coming up with is a concept where you actually have three or four holes that are in a cluster with houses built all around that cluster. So you look out your back door and all of a sudden you're looking over two golf holes instead of one.
Mm. Which is much prettier.
Or maybe even three golf holes. Okay.
Mm-hmm. So, but that would be much more visually appealing for the homeowner.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
But what I'm doing is I'm routing it in a way to where that landing area where it's a 400 foot circle, maybe I'm making it a 600 foot circle, but I'm having two holes that kind of hit toward the same landing zone and then dogleg away from each other. So there's no safety factor.
Okay. And what about shared greens?
Shared greens don't really work.
Hmm.
they're very difficult to do. They work in theory, but when you start thinking about cart paths and you start thinking about access and you start thinking about all those things, it's very difficult to plan for those.
Mm-hmm. And has all of this Is this dilemma unique to the United States, or is this going on globally?
I think it's going on globally. But I think the United States is so far ahead as far as golf development that we're starting to realize it first.
Oh, with the saturation point in the United States?
Yes. I think we're starting to encounter all these problems and issues before most people because our development rate has been so high for so long that we're just to that point. I mean, golf development is relatively new in all other parts of the world. I mean, China just started doing courses, 2 years ago?
And they went crazy.
They're going crazy.
Yeah. What is that, Mission Hills? Is that what it's called?
What's going on in China? See, I've been over in China, and it's really an interesting dynamic there. Okay?
Explain.
In China, you have all these villages, okay? They've been there forever. And you have all this big business that's coming to China from the U.S. and from everywhere else, and all these headquarters that are relocating there, and all these things that are happening. And they're all going to the cities, right? Well, these villages are starting to get smart, and they're starting to say, well, wait a minute, we want some of this action, we want some of the pie. How do we attract these corporations to come to our village to do this. Well, realizing that a majority of the people who are going to work in these facilities are going to be imported or are going to come from America or wherever to live there, they have to develop something that's going to give these people something to do when they're not working. So what's the logical explanation? Golf. Right?
Yeah.
Give them a hobby.
Yeah.
So what these villages have started doing was they were going in and actually displacing the people who lived in their villages to other areas so that they could then take that village and transform it into something more appealing to these big businesses. Well, big government in China got a hold of that all their villagers were being displaced. And we can't do that.
No.
We just can't do that. Okay? But if you look at what's happened in China in the last 3 years, what's the number one retail store that just went into China in the last 3 years?
Starbucks?
Walmart.
Walmart, of course.
Do you know why?
Keep going. You do.
Walmart started developing in China because all of a sudden they were getting an influx of cash and these people were moving out of their villages and they had a whole new lifestyle. And with a new lifestyle comes the need for new things.
Oh, interesting.
So Walmart went in there and said, we can sell you toothpaste, we can sell you deodorant, we can sell you all these things that you never used before. And I got to tell you, they didn't use them. I've been to some of these villages. They barely had running water. Okay? People they're displacing, they're putting into condos. They're putting them into new buildings. They're putting them into new things. The people aren't used to that.
No.
So it's really creating this whole middle class in China that they never had before, and it's creating quite an uprising because they have a head government that's saying, well, we don't know how to handle a middle class.
Oh, wow.
And I know we're getting off the subject of golf, but not really. Development is driven by different things over there.
Right.
It's just driven differently. So I don't know. I mean, it'll be interesting. Plus, golf is added to the Olympics in 2016. So the Chinese are wanting to build golf courses so they can start training athletes.
Sure. Sure.
So that's, you know, they don't want to be embarrassed.
No, they don't like that.
No.
No, I don't think that would work well. So what is your prediction for the future of golf course development? Not the game of golf itself, but the future of golf course development from your perspective.
Standalone courses, such as municipal courses that are just golf, are going to fail because you can't design and build them and maintain them for the cost that you're going to recoup by bringing people through the door. So you're going to see very few new standalone 18-hole courses built. Okay? You're still going to see some development courses built. Development meaning housing, golf. You're still going to have some of that. Resort courses are going to go on the rise because they're going to be destination courses. So anything that's a destination course where people are willing to go and they're willing to pay $300 to play because they can brag to all their buddies they played there, those are going to continue to be on the rise.
And
now,
the future of 18 holes?
Future 18-hole courses is going to be nine-hole developments with high-end learning centers. I think you're going to see a lot of learning centers pop up. I think you're going to see a lot of learning centers pop up in business parks, high-end business parks, where guys come in, they have meetings, whatever. You're going to have a lot of executive nines and high-end learning centers pop up right in the middle of those things.
And will the will the nine-hole courses feature two par three and two par fives, or just be par with
if
like
enough space?
Yeah, they'll just have space. A par five and a five par threes.
Probably. It's going to be more along that end.
Mm-hmm. So that makes it more appealing to the seniors and women?
I'm sorry.
I was asking, does that make it more appealing? Say you have one par five, five par threes, and a couple par fours. Is that going to make it more appealing to the females and seniors?
And
is that the target marketplace?
Yeah.
As the baby boomers get older.
Yep. Exactly. And the other reason that you're going to see more of these developing in business parks, and this is a real important point I think that should be made, is because business parks are all concrete. Parking lots in a building. And they have to have some way to soften that stormwater drainage before it floods everything downstream. So what they're going to end up doing is building all their buildings up high, letting all the water filter through the golf course, letting all the water sit in the pond for the golf course, and then it filters out naturally. You use the golf course when the weather's nice. The golf course may be flooded three times a year, but who cares?
And it comes back to what you originally talked about, the 3 Ds of design. Everyone sing along with us. Drainage.
And I know that sounds boring, but it's really fascinating. I mean, that's what drives projects. It really is. So
that makes total sense. And of course, being just someone who likes to play golf, that's not something that would ever cross my mind, but it makes total sense.
Yeah. Yeah, because they're basically using open land for a recreational sport that they can gain some, you know, notoriety for instead of just turning it into park space and wasteland.
Right, there's cachet to it. That generates its own revenue as opposed to parkland, which doesn't necessarily generate any revenue.
Exactly. But it doesn't stand alone. I mean, you still have to supplement it, but at least you're given a product that you can supplement. I mean, you know. You can assess fees. You can do whatever you need to do to keep the golf course open. Mm. So.
What an education you've provided for us, Chuck. Thank you.
Well, you're very welcome. You're very welcome.
This has just been, to me, it's been very interesting. I mean, I wanted to talk more about strategy and how you do strategy, but there was so much elements of design that incorporates into the business of golf courses. I found this very fascinating. Thanks so much.
Yeah. Well, you're very welcome. You're very welcome. And again, I think the best golf courses are the ones that can take all that technical aspect that we spend a majority of our time talking about, and then create a visually appealing, playable, shot-value golf course. And that's where a good golf course architect sits. He has the ability to pull all that technical aspect and make it look great. That's the value.
Anything on your website you want to promote that we need to come look at?
Well, my website is kind of set up just with job history, but I do a lot of writing, freelance writing for a local golf magazine. Some of the articles are posted on there. It's really kind of a unique website, so if you have a chance, just go visit it. I promise you might learn something. You can contact me.
Yeah, if these two conversations are any indication of what we can learn from your articles, yeah, I think that there's going to definitely be something there worth of value to all of us. And the website is Ermisch Golf, right? ERMISCH.
Yes, ERMISCHgolf.com.
All right, and it's Chuck Ermisch. Thank you so much again for joining us for these two episodes. I found it absolutely fascinating. And I hope others have as well.
Well, I hope so, too.
And ultimately, that is the bottom line. We hope that you enjoyed it as well. Hey, how would you like to win a great training aid that will have you striking the ball well with much more consistency? I know, it's a stupid question. We're giving away a brand new Tour Tempo Micro Player to any Golf Smarter listener. Now, as a member, automatically you are entered for our drawings, but you can increase your chances by entering again because Golf Smarter members are allowed to have their name in twice, so you have a better chance of winning. To enter, go to golfsmarter.com and click on Contest. Deadline for entry is October 1, 2010. To learn more about the Tour Tempo, go back into our archives You have access to those archives. Listen to episodes number 191 and 192 with the inventor John Novosel. Okay, so because this is a members-only episode, I wanted to give you a head start on something that non-members won't know about for a couple of weeks, if at all. Normally, we sell the Tour Tempo Micro Player on our website for $94.95 plus shipping. That has been dictated by John Novosel. But, as I've always explained, part of the benefit of being a member is, of course, automatic entry into the contest and discounts on selected items. What we've always sold the Tour Tempo for the past year and have sold a bunch of them for $64.95 to our members. But for a limited time, or while supplies last, we are selling the Tour Tempo Micro Player to our members for only $49.95 plus shipping. That's basically half price for one of these units. So if you are coming up to your off season, this is a great tool to keep your swing tempo in a groove, or use it on the range like I continue to do every time. That's the Tour Tempo Micro Player on sale right now in our Golfers Mart for members only at only $49.95 plus shipping at golfsmarter.com. We close with six words on golf that we found on LinkedIn group discussion as suggested by Stan Mendoza. 135 yards? 9 iron. If you have six words on golf that describes your passion, post them on our Facebook group or click on the Hey Fred button at golfsmarter.com.
Smarterpodcasts.com. Delivering sound advice.